One of your pots, the man said.
Sure. Big or little?
Big.
Here.
Thanks.
The man seemed more relaxed now, although his eyes still darted about, and he jumped at slight noises.
Where were you when it all...
The man gestured vaguely.
Jet Propulsion Laboratories, Pasadena. I saw it all. We had live TV pictures from the Hammer Lab satellite.
All? What does that mean?
There were a lot of strikes, mostly east of here, Europe, the Atlantic, but some close, some south of us. So I drove north until I lost my car. Do you know if the San Joaquin nuclear plant is working?
No. There's an ocean where the San Joaquin Valley used to be.
What about Sacramento?
Don't know.
The man seemed indecisive, but his rifle still looked Dan steadily in the eye. An ounce of pressure and Dan Forrester would not exist.
Dan was surprised to learn just how much he cared, just how much he wanted to live, even though he knew he had no real chance. If he lived until winter, he'd die then.
He estimated that many more than half those who lived until winter would not see the spring.
We were on a training run, the man said. Army. When the trucks went into a ditch, some of us shot the officer and went into business for ourselves. Way Gillings told it, that would be a good idea. I went along. I mean, it was all dead anyway, you know?
The man poured out words in a rush. He needed to justify himself before he killed Dan Forrester.
But then we had to walk and walk and walk, and we couldn't find any food, and...
The words cut off, suddenly, with a dark shadow of hate that crossed the soldier's face. Then,
I wish you had more food. I'm taking your jacket.
Just like that.
Take it off. We didn't have any rain gear.
You're too big. It won't fit, Dan said.
I'll tough it out somehow.
The bandit was shivering, and of course he was as wet as Dan himself. He wasn't carrying much fat for insulation, either.
It's just a windbreaker, not waterproof.
A windbreaker is fine. I can take it off you, you know.
Sure, with a hole in it. Or maybe not. A headshot doesn't put holes in jackets. Dan took off the jacket. He was about to throw it to the bandit when he thought of something.
Watch,
he said. He stuffed the hood into the narrow pocket in the collar and zipped it up. Then he turned the big pocket inside out and stuffed the entire jacket into it. The package was now the size of two fists. Dan zipped it closed and tossed it.
Huh, said the bandit.
Do you know what you're stealing?
Dan's bitter sense of loss went deeper than his common sense.
They can't make the materials anymore. They can't make the machines to shape it. There was a company in New Jersey, and it made that jacket in 5 sizes, and sold it so cheap you could toss one in your car trunk and forget it for 10 years. You didn't even have to go looking for it. The company hunted you down and sent you thick packets of advertisements. How long will it be before anyone can do that again?
The man nodded.
He began backing into the trees, but stopped.
Don't go west, he said.
We killed a man and a woman and ate them.
We.
I didn't want anyone else to see how I felt. Next chance I got, I went off on my own. So don't cry real tears over this jacket. Just be glad there ain't no dry wood around.
The bandit laughed a funny, painful laugh, turned, and ran. Dan shook his head. Cannibalism so soon. But he still had the net undershirt and the t-shirt and a long-sleeved flannel shirt and the sweater. He'd been lucky, and he knew it. Presently, he began putting the pack back together. He still had his snare wire, more precious than the jacket. A few feet of thin, strong wire, a spool of strong monofilament. Life itself, for a little while. He put on his pack. Don't go west. The San Joaquin nuclear project was west, but the San Joaquin was filled with water. The plant couldn't have survived that. And besides, it wasn't finished. That left Sacramento. Dan called up a mental picture of California. He was in the hills that formed the eastern boundary of the flooded Central Valley. He'd intended to work his way down to lower ground, where the going wouldn't be so rough. But the low ground was to the west. The cannibals were between him and the spreading lake that the San Joaquin had become. Best to go north and stay in the foothills. Dan didn't expect to live, but he had a violent antipathy to helping the cannibals. Sergeant Hooker watched the sky as he marched. The wind acted like a horde of catnip-maddened kittens. It slashed playfully under helmet rims, plucked at sleeves and pant legs, died for an instant, then whipped dust in the eye from a wholly different direction. The clouds, black and pregnant in the underbelly, shifted uneasily, promising violence. It hadn't rained in hours. Even by post-Hammerfall standards, this weather could do anything. The doctor marched in sullen silence, pushing himself to keep up. He didn't have strength left over to run. At least Hooker didn't have that worry. But he worried about the grumbling behind him. No words reached him, only the flavor of complaint and anger. He thought, "We wouldn't eat each other, of course. There are limits. We don't even eat our dead. Yet. Should I have pushed that? There were complaints. I may have to shoot Gillings." He probably would have shot Gillings there at first, when he came back and found Captain Hora dead and Gillings in charge, but he hadn't had any ammunition then, and the way Gillings told it, they'd set up in business for themselves. They'd be fucking kings now that the Hammer had finished civilization. That was funny, but Sergeant Hooker wasn't laughing. In random anger, he told the doctor, "If we have to stop again, they'll eat you." His own belly rumbled.
"I know, I told you why you get sick," said the doctor.
He was short and harmless-looking, half-chipmunk, the resemblance accented by a brush of mustache under his forward-thrusting nose. He was sticking close to Hooker, which was sensible.
"You eat steak rare," he said. "There aren't too many diseases you can catch from a steer. You eat pork well done, because pigs carry some diseases men catch, too. Parasites and such."
He paused for breath, and to see if Hooker would backhand him to shut up, but Hooker didn't.
"But you can catch anything from a man, except maybe sickle cell anemia. You've lost 15 men since you turned cannibal."
"8 got shot. You saw it."
"They were too sick to run."
"Hell, they were the recruits. Didn't know what they were doing."
The doctor didn't say anything for a while. They trudged on, no sound but panting as they climbed the damp hillside. 8 men shot, 4 of them recruits. But 7 of the army men had died too, and not from bullets.
"We've all been sick," the doctor said. "We're sick now."
His thoughts made him gag.
"God, I wish I hadn't."
"You was just as hungry as us. What if you was too weak to walk?"
Hooker wondered why he bothered. The doctor's feelings were nothing to him. Vindictively, he hugged his secret to him. When they found a place to settle, then they could lame the doctor, like the cavemen lamed their blacksmiths to keep them from running away. But the need hadn't come yet. Somewhere there had to be a place small enough to defend, big enough to support Hooker's company. A farm community, with enough people in it to work the land, and enough land to feed everybody. The company could set up there. Good troops had to be worth something. That goddamn Gillings. The way he told it, they could just walk in and take over. It hadn't worked out that way. Too hungry. Too damn many miles coming out of the hills, and all the stores looted, all the people run off or barricaded up, so even the bazookas and the recoilless wouldn't make it sure. Hooker wanted to think about something else. If they'd fought earlier, it would have been all right. But no. He let himself get talked out of that, talked into moving on to look for a better place, and by the time they got to it...
"If you've got to eat human meat..."
The doctor couldn't leave it alone. He had to talk about it. His face wrinkled and he fought nausea. Hooker hoped it was just in the doctor's head.
"If you've got to eat human meat, the ones you want are the healthy ones, the ones who run the fastest and shoot back the best. The ones you can catch are the sick ones. The meat makes you sick, too. Better you eat diseased cattle than sick men."
"Shut up, pussy doctor. You know why they died. They died because you're not a real doctor at all. You're only a pussy doctor."
"Sure. First time you catch a real doctor, I'm for the pot.
Stick close to me if you want to live that long.
Cowles had been a gynecologist before Hammerfall. He had left a commercial hunting lodge and driven downslope in the endless rain and stopped at the border of the new sea that covered the San Joaquin Valley. Hooker's band had found him there, sitting on the fender of his car in the pouring rain, slack-jawed and fresh out of ideas. If Cowles had not had just enough sense to name his profession, he would have joined the stewpot then. He had protested at being conscripted into the army, until Hooker told him the true situation. He was docile enough now. There had been no more mumbling about the rights of the citizen. Hooker didn't doubt that he did the best he could to save lives, and he marched as fast as the slowest of them, with the stewpot following behind, carried by three men who were still healthy. Gillings was one of them. It gave Hooker an extra measure of safety. Gillings would have to drop the stewpot before he shot Hooker in the back. Hooker didn't want to shoot anyone. They'd already lost too many men, to disease, to desertion, to the guns in the valley behind them. Who'd have thought those farmers could put up such a good fight against a military outfit with modern weapons? Only it wasn't a very good military outfit, and they didn't have much ammunition, and they hadn't been very smart about anything. No time to train the recruits, no real discipline among the troops, everybody edgy, wondering if a real army patrol was out looking for them, or even a bunch of civilian cops. There wasn't any turning back, though, not now, and they couldn't march faster than the news. What they needed was more recruits, only they couldn't do much recruiting until they had plenty to eat. Economics could be a terrible enemy. To kill a man for the pot and gather the fuel and water to make him meat required a given amount of effort. If the company's numbers dropped too low, the meat would spoil before it could be eaten. Waste of effort, waste of murder. It was small wonder that Hooker felt he was pursued by furies. Nothing had worked right since Hammerfall Day, and that was weeks ago. He'd forgotten exactly how many days, but two troopers kept an independent record, crossing off days on pocket calendar cards. If Sergeant Hooker needed to know precisely, he could find out. He'd learned to delegate other responsibilities, too. He had to. As a sergeant, he'd done the detail work. Now that he was effectively the commanding officer, he couldn't. He didn't think too much about how good an officer he was. There wasn't anybody else to do it. Left, right, away from that valley, back south again, where they might find some place to stop, new recruits, something to eat besides... He studied the clouds and wondered if they were really moving in a counterclockwise whirlpool. The only cover in sight was a house, ahead and downslope. He ought to send scouts now. Shelter might be needed. He hoped it was abandoned, and maybe there'd be some canned goods inside. Not bloody likely.
Bascom, Flash, cover that farmhouse. See if anybody's home. If there is, get 'em talking, not shooting.
Right, Sarge. Two troopers, two of the healthy ones, broke from the formation and ran down the hill.
Talk them to death?
The doctor asked.
I need recruits, pussy doctor. And we have some stewed meat left, enough to last another day.
Hooker spoke absently. He was still watching Bascom and Flash as they moved toward the farmhouse, and that weather worried him. It was only just past noon, but the clouds did seem to be moving in a bathtub whirlpool pattern. Something bright showed in the clouds. It couldn't be sunlight breaking through. It was only a ruddy pinpoint, moving very fast, almost parallel to the clouds, dipping in and out of their dark underbellies. Hooker cried,
"No!"
Dr. Cowles edged away, suspecting madness.
"No,"
Hooker said softly.
"No, no, no. We can't take it. Enough is enough, don't you understand? It has to stop now,"
Hooker explained, his eyes on the falling bright point. He couldn't take it. Nobody could take it if the hammer should fall again. His prayer was answered, weirdly, as a parachute bloomed behind the meteorite. Hooker stared, not understanding.
"It's a spacecraft," Cowles said. "I'll be damned, Hooker, it's a spacecraft.
must be from Hammer Lab. Hooker, are you all right?
Shut up.
Hooker watched the descending parachute. Gillings bellowed from behind him.
Hey, Sergeant, what does an astronaut taste like? Like turkey?
You'll never know,
Hooker called, and it was good that his voice was under control. Good that only Cowles had seen his face. Cowles wouldn't talk.
They're coming down in the valley, right where those farmers shot the shit out of us yesterday.
Falling east, blind. Clouds shone fiercely bright beneath the meteorite Soyuz. Here and there were whirlpool patterns, hurricane patterns. North of their path there had been a towering spike of cloud, a mother of hurricanes spinning off little ones above the hot water that must still cover the Pacific strike. The small window shook with the Soyuz's vibration, and Johnny Baker's eyes vibrated in a different pattern. The Soyuz dipped low, dipped in and out of the cloud deck, and in, and the view went from gray-white gradually to gray-dark.
"Could be anything down there," he reported.
Falling more steeply now, out of the clouds, but it was still dark below. Land, sea, swamp, it didn't matter. They were committed. The Soyuz had no fuel, no power, no way to maneuver. They'd stayed up as long as they could, until they were down to their last few pounds of oxygen, the last of their rations, until Hammer Lab, with its low electrical power because of the sandblasted solar cells, was almost intolerably hot, until they couldn't stay in orbit any longer and had to return to a blasted Earth. It had seemed appropriate to make mankind's last spaceflight last as long as possible. Maybe they'd done some good. They'd been able to pinpoint the strikes and broadcast their locations. They'd seen the rockets rise and fall and the atomic blasts, and that was all over now. The Sino-Russian War went on, and might last forever, but it wasn't fought with atomic weapons any longer. They'd seen it all and broadcast what they saw, and somebody heard them. There'd been an acknowledgment from Pretoria, and another from New Zealand, and almost 5 minutes of conversation with NORAD and Colorado Springs. Not a lot to show for 4 weeks in orbit past Hammerfall, but they'd have stayed if there'd been nothing. The last of the space travelers.
"Parachute opening," Peter said from behind him.
Innocuous words, but something in the tone made Johnny brace himself. It was just as well.
"Rough ride," Rick said from behind his other ear. "Maybe because we're overloaded."
"No, it's always like this," Leonila said. "Are your Apollos more comfortable?"
"I never came down in one," Rick answered. "It must be easier on the nerves. We wear pressure suits."
"Here there is no room," Peter said. "I have told you, we made the design different after that trouble that killed 3 cosmonauts. We have no leaks, da?"
"Da." The view was clearing and coming up fast.
"I think we are too far south," Peter said. "The winds were not predictable."
"So long as we get down,"
Johnny Baker said. He looked down at the solid sheet of water below.
"Can we all swim?"
Leonila chuckled.
"Can we all wade? The water doesn't look deep. In fact..."
She stared down at the scene below while the others waited. She was in the chair beside Johnny. Peter and Rick were in the cramped space behind them.
"In fact, we are moving inland, east. I see 4 people running from a house."
200 meters, Johnny Baker said. "Get set. We're coming in. 100, 50, 25.
Splot. The overburdened Soyuz landed hard. That felt like land. Johnny sighed and let muscles go limp one by one. No more vibration, scream of air, fear of explosive decompression, or death by drowning. They were down. They were all soaked in sweat. It had been a hot ride.
"Everybody okay?"
Johnny asked.
"Rog."
"Yes, thank you."
"Let's get the hell out," Rick said.
Johnny didn't see the hurry, but Rick and Peter must be hellishly cramped back there. Rick had suggested the arrangement himself, but that wouldn't make it more comfortable. Johnny fumbled with the unfamiliar locks. They wouldn't work until he cursed them. Then the latch popped open.
"Oops."
"What is it?"
Rick asked. Leonila craned to look past him.
"Curtain time," said Johnny.
He stood in the hatch and smiled brilliantly into a crowd that bristled with shotguns and rifles. More than a dozen men faced him, and no women. He wasn't counting, but he saw half a dozen shotguns and a lot of rifles and revolvers, and, Jesus, two army submachine guns. He raised his hands. It wasn't easy to keep them high and still scramble out of the capsule. What were they all so damned nervous about? He moved, rotated, so they could see the U.S. flag on his shoulder.
"Don't shoot! I'm a hero!"
They were not a prepossessing lot. They were half-drowned rats in farm clothes, much the worse for total disaster, and their faces were as grim as their guns. There were a couple of bloody bandages in evidence, too. Johnny had a sudden wild impulse to speak in pigeon talk.
"Me fella big astronaut, come from same country belong you fella."
He controlled it. One spoke from the semicircle. He was white-haired and stout, though not as stout as his coveralls. They had all shrunk within their clothes. But his arms were as thick as a wrestler's. The lightweight machine gun looked fragile in his big hands.
"Tell us, hero, how you come to be in a commie airplane?"
"Spaceship. We're from Hammerlab. You know about Hammerlab?"
"Head belong you fella. Him savvy big rocket go up, up, up in sky. Long time not come down."
"Hammerlab was the joint Apollo-Soyuz mission in space. We went up to study the comet."
"We know."
"Okay, the Apollo got a hole poked through it. We think it got hit by a snowflake moving at God's own speed. We had to beg a ride home with the Soviets, in their spaceship. I'm..."
"Johnny Baker! I know him! That's Johnny Baker!"
The voice belonged to a man. Thin, limp black hair, slender fingers wrapped around an enormous shotgun.
"Hey!"
"Pleased to meet you," said Johnny, and he was. "Would it hurt if I put my hands down?"
"Go ahead," said the white-haired spokesman. He was obviously the man in charge, partly by tradition, partly because of bull strength. The submachine gun didn't hurt his leadership credentials. It hadn't moved, aimed not quite at Johnny.
"Who else is in there?"
"The other astronauts, two Soviets and another American. It's crowded in there. They'd like to come out if, well, if you people can stay calm about it."
"Nobody excited here," the spokesman said. "Bring out your friends. I've got some questions for them. Like, why did the commies come down here?"
"Where could we go? Only one spaceship for the four of us. Leonila."
She stepped out, smiling, her hands slightly raised. Johnny announced,
"Leonila Malik, the first woman in space."
It wasn't strictly true, but it sounded good. The hard stares softened. The white-haired man lowered his weapon.
"I'm Deke Wilson," he said. "Come on out, miss, or is it comrade?"
"Whatever you choose," she said.
She scrambled down from the open hatchway and stood blinking at the reflected light off the sheet of water 200 yards to the west.
"My first visit to America, or outside the Soviet Union. They wouldn't let me out before."
"Others coming," Johnny said. "Peter."
Brigadier General Jakov was not smiling. His hands were high and his back was straight, the hammer and sickle and CCCP prominent on his shoulder. The farmers were looking wary again.
"General Peter Jakov,"
Johnny announced, making the pronunciation very Russian in the hope that nobody would get smart-mouthed about the name.
"There's one more."
"Rick?"
A couple of the farmers were giving their friends knowing looks. Rick emerged, also smiling, making certain that the U.S. flag showed.
"Colonel Rick Delante, U.S. Air Force," Johnny said.
The farmers were relaxing a little.
"First black man in space," Rick said, "and the last for about 1,000 years. He paused. "We're all the last."
"For a while, maybe not that long,"
Deke Wilson said. He slipped the submachine gun back on its shoulder strap so that it pointed to the sky. There was a subtle change in the way the others held their weapons. Now they were a group of farmers who happened to be carrying guns. One of the men flashed a mischievous grin.
"They made you ride in back."
"Well, it was the only bus out there," Rick said. There were laughs.
"Derek, take your boys and get back to the roadblock," Wilson said.
He turned back to Baker.
"We're a little nervous here," he said. "Some army mutineers running around the area. Killed an Armenian chap down the road and ate him. Ate him. One of the kids got to us. We had some warning. Ambushed the sons of..."
"We ambushed them. But there's still a lot of them left. And others. City people. People with rabies."
"Is it that bad?" Leonila said. "That bad so quickly?"
"Maybe we shouldn't have come down," Rick said.
"There are vital records in the spacecraft." Peter Jakov laid a hand possessively on the Soyuz. "They must be preserved. Is there any place they can be studied? Any scientists or universities near here?"
The farmers laughed. "Universities? General Baker, look around you. Take a good look," Deke Wilson said.
John Baker stared at the desolation surrounding him. To the east were rain-drenched hills, some green, most barren. All the low areas were filled with water. The highway that ran north and east looked more like a series of concrete islands than a road. To the west was a vast inland sea, lapped with waves a foot high, dotted with small brown hills that had become islands. Treetops rose from the water in regular arrays where an orchard was not quite submerged. A few boats moved across this sea. The water was muddy, dark, and dangerous, and it stank with dead things, cattle, and... The remains of a rag doll bobbed gently with the waves. It floated about 30 yards offshore. Not far from it, perhaps somehow attached to it, were wisps of blonde hair and checkered cloth, not recognizable as the remains of anything human. Deke Wilson followed Baker's look, then turned away toward the farmhouse standing on the hill above the sea.
"Nothing we can do," he said. His voice was bitter. "We could spend all our time burying them, all of it, and we'd still not get it done."
It was then that the full horror of Hammerfall struck Johnny Baker.
"It doesn't go clean," he said.
Wilson frowned a question.
"It isn't just bang and it's over. Civilization's fallen and we have to rebuild it. There's the aftermath, and that's worse than the comet."
"Damn right," Wilson said. "You're goddamn lucky, Baker. You missed the worst of it."
"There is no central government," Peter Jakov asked.
"You're looking at it," Wilson said. "Bill Appleby there, the deputy sheriff, but it's nothing special. We haven't heard from Sacramento since Hammerfall."
"But surely someone is organizing, is trying," Leonila said.
"Yeah, there's the senator's people," Wilson said.
"Senator?"
John Baker kept his face from showing emotion. He turned away from the terrible inland sea toward the hills to the east.
"Senator Arthur Jellison," Deke Wilson said.
"You sound like you don't like him much," Rick Delante said.
"Not exactly. Can't blame him, but I don't have to like him."
"What's he done?" Baker asked.
"He's organized," Wilson said. "That valley of his..."
Wilson pointed north and east, toward the foothills of the High Sierra.
"Is ringed with hills. They've got patrols, border guards, and they don't let anybody in without their say-so. You want help, they'll send it, but the price is damned high. Feed their troops, and send back more food, oil, ammunition, fertilizer, all the things you can't get now."
"If you have oil, I think you'd be in good shape," Rick Delante said.
Wilson waved expansively.
"How do we hold on to this place? No borders, no rock piles to make into fortresses, no time to build, no way to keep refugees from coming in and looting what we haven't got to yet. You want to lock that thing up? I'd rather not have this many people standing around. There's work to do. Always work to do."
"Yes, the records should be safe."
Peter climbed onto the Soyuz and closed the hatch.
"No electricity," Johnny Baker said. "What about nuclear plants, the one near Sacramento?"
Wilson shrugged.
Sacto used to be about 25 feet above sea level. Things got shifted in the quakes. That plant could be underwater. Maybe not. I just don't know. There's better than 250 miles of swamp and lake between here and there, and most of the valley's under deep water. Got that locked up. Let's go.
They walked up the hill toward the farmhouse. When they got closer, Baker saw the sandbags and foxholes dug in around the buildings. Women and children worked to add to the fortifications. Wilson looked thoughtful.
General, you ought to be doing something better than digging foxholes, but I don't know what it would be.
Johnny Baker didn't say anything. He was overwhelmed by what he'd seen and learned. There was no civilization here at all, only desperate farmers trying to hold a few acres of ground.
We can work, Rick Delante said.
You'll have to,
Wilson said.
Look, in a few weeks we'll hear from the senator. I'll give word that you're here. Maybe he'll want you. Maybe he'll want you bad enough to think he owes us for sending you. I could use him owing us.
Fourth week. The Prophet. Of all states, that is the worst whose rulers no longer enjoy an authority sufficiently extensive for everyone to obey them with good grace, but in which their authority over a part of their subjects is sufficiently large to enable them to constrain others. Bertrand de Jouvenal, Sovereignty. There had been a crazy world. It was vivid in Alim Nassor's memory. Once the honkies had poured bread into the ghettos, bribes to stop riots, and Alim had taken his share. Not just money, there was power, and Alim was known in City Hall, was headed for something bigger. Then a black Tom was mayor, and the money stopped, the power vanished. Alim couldn't stand that. Without money and the symbols you could buy with it, you were nothing. Less than the pimps and the pushers and the other garbage that made their living out of the ghettos. He'd lost his power and had to have it back. But then he was caught ripping off a store, and the only way to get off was to pay a bondsman and a lawyer, both honkies. They got him out on bail, and then to pay them he had to rip off another store. Crazy. Then hundreds of the richest honkies had run for the hills. Doom was coming from the sky. Alim and his brothers had been set to make themselves rich forever. They'd been rich. They'd had truckloads of what the fences paid money for. And then... crazy. Crazy. Alim Nassor remembered, but it was like a dope dream, the time before the hammer. He'd done his best to protect the brothers who would listen to him. 4 of the 6 burglary teams had made it through the rain and the quakes and the refugees, all those people. But they made it to the cabin near Grapevine. The engine in one of the trucks had a death rattle. They'd stripped it and siphoned off the gas and ditched it. They'd dumped all that electrical stuff, too. TVs, hi-fis, radios, the small computers. But they'd kept the telescope and binoculars. And they'd been all right for a while. There was a ranch not far from the cabin, and there'd been cattle and some other food. Enough to last 2 dozen brothers a long time. They hadn't even had to fight for it. The rancher was dead under his collapsed roof, leg broken, and he'd starved or bled to death. But then a lot of honkies with guns came and took it away, and 18 brothers in 3 trucks had to take off into a howling rain. Then things really went to hell. Nothing to eat, no place to go. Nobody wanted blacks. What were they supposed to do? Starve? Alim Nassor sat cross-legged in the rain, half-dozing, remembering. There had been a crazy world, with laws drawn up by gibbering idiots and unbelievable luxuries. Hot coffee, steak dinners, dry towels. Alim wore a coat that fit him perfectly. A woman's mink coat, as wet as any sponge. None of the brothers had anything to say about that. Once again, Alim Nassor had power. There were few feet in his field of view. Stolen boots burst at the seams, the soles worn thin by walking. Alim looked up. Swan was a lightweight who carried all manner of sharp things on his person. He'd looked lean as a dancer, cool and dangerous, when Alim went to him with the burglary proposition. Now he looked half-starved and diffident. He said,
"Jackie been messing with Cassie again. Cassie don't like it. I think she told Chick."
"Shit." Alim stood up.
"We should kill that chick," Swan said.
"Now you listen good." Alim was dismayed at the lack of force in his voice. He was tired. Tired. He leaned close to Swan and spoke low, letting the threat show. "We need Chick. I'd kill Jackie before I killed Chick. And I'd kill you." Swan backed up.
"Okay, Alim."
Alim savored that. Swan hadn't gone for a blade. He'd backed off. Alim still had power.
"Chick's the biggest, strongest brother we got, but that isn't the reason," Alim said. "Chick's a farmer. A farmer, you got that? You want to do this the rest of your life? Man, we were on foot for 10 days. Did you like that? There's got to be a place for us somewhere, but it don't matter if we can't farm."
"Let somebody else do the fucking work," Swan said.
"And how do you know if they do it right?" Alim demanded.
"We..." He was on the verge of letting desperation show.
"Where's Chick?"
"By the fire. And Jackie isn't."
"Cassie?"
"With Chick."
"Good." Alim walked down toward the fire. It felt good to know he could turn his back on Swan and nothing was going to happen. Swan needed him. They all needed him. None of the rest could have got them this far, and they all knew it. The first week after Hammerfall, it rained all the time. Then it dwindled off to a drizzle, and that went on and on until nobody could stand it, and still it went on. Now, 4 weeks after the Hammer of God, it drizzled more often than not, and it always rained, hard, at least once every day. Today it had rained 3 times, and the drizzle kept on. The rain was hard on everybody. It rasped nerves. It rotted feet in their boots. Everything was hopelessly wet, and people could be killed for a dry place. The drizzle stopped, almost, at midnight. Now everyone was huddled around the fire under a sheet plastic lean-to. Tomorrow Alim might regret letting them use gas for a fire, but shit, they'd probably run out of road before the truck they'd ripped off in Oil City ran out of gas. Most roads ended at a low spot, underwater, and you had to backtrack for miles to find a way around a stretch only a few dozen yards across. Crazy. Where the roads did get across low spots, there was often a roadblock. Farmers with guns. And they needed a fire. The gasoline had dried out enough wood to make it burn, but it smoked horribly. 20 brothers and 5 sisters were all crouched in a crescent, upwind, they hoped, under a billowing plastic sheet, while the smoke curled around and sometimes sought them out. Alim heard laughter and was glad. It was bad to have women in a gang like this. Worse to have no women. Alim wondered if he'd made a mistake, but it was too late now. Shit. Alim Nassor's mistakes could kill them all, and that, if you liked, was power. They'd come down into the valley with 18 brothers, no women. The people they'd met had been mostly white, mostly starving, mostly unable to fight. Alim's band had looted for food and dry places and killed where they had to. When they met blacks, they recruited. There were damn few blacks this far north, and most were farmers, and some didn't want to join. That was good for Alim. Fewer mouths to feed. And bad for them. Blacks would not be popular where Alim's band had passed. And as always, they moved on. They had found no place they could hold and defend. There were never enough brothers, and always behind them were farmers with guns, the remnants of police forces, survivors with nothing left to live for except killing Alim Nassor's people. And now there were 5 women and 20 men. 4 men had died fighting over women. 3 had been the husbands. 1 of the widows had killed herself that same day. Alim was grateful. It had cooled things for a while. But not for long. Mabe's husband had been knifed in his sleep, and now Mabe was sleeping around, but in a strange fashion. Where she went, there were fights. Maybe she was taking revenge. But what could Aleem do about it? If he killed her, it would have to look like an accident. You can't kill the only pussy the brothers were getting. Maybe at the right time, if there was another big fight and everybody knew she caused it. Chick and Cassie were a different problem. They were farmers. Their farm was part of an ocean now, the ocean that had been the San Joaquin Valley. They talked like redneck honkies. They didn't understand the speech of the city blood. Cassie was willowy, dignified, strong, and lovely. Chick was a burly giant who could lift the back end of a car or pick up a brother like Swan by one ankle and throw him pinwheeling a dozen feet through the air, and he'd done that. They'd lost two kids under the water. If the kids had been saved, Aleem shook his head. Kids were the last thing this gang needed now. But in another sense, if Cassie had come on as a mother with two kids, maybe the brothers would think more about protecting her, less about getting into her. They looked up as Aleem strode into their midst, and Aleem saw smiles. Yeah, the fire had been a good idea. Chick and Cassie were sitting with their arms around one another, staring broodingly into the fire. Aleem squatted down before them and said, "Do we want to talk about something?" Chick shook his big head. Cassie didn't move. "You sure?" Chick said,
"Keep your thieves away from my woman."
"I'm trying. It's nobody's fault. It's just the way things are. Anyone special?"
"Jackie, you know that son of a bitch pulled a knife on her."
"He just showed it to me," Cassie said, "but it scared me."
"You're not scared of guns," Aleem said. She had a tremendous revolver and half a dozen kinds of handloads, from birdshot to a slug that would stop a bear. Aleem had never dreamed a revolver could do so many things at once. "Why knives?" She just shook her head, and Chick glared. Aleem stood up. "I'll try to fix it. Where is he?"
"Hiding out."
Aleem nodded and went. Now, should he just hang around, or try to track Jackie? Hang around. He moved among the brothers and sisters, making himself visible in the firelight. Tomorrow they'd remember. But time wore on, and the brothers and sisters spilled into the truck in twos and threes. The drizzle was winning out over the fire, and Jackie still hadn't come in. Aleem had already decided where he must be. To one side was the shoreline they'd been following for a week. Aleem had wondered if they ought to strike off into the hills. But for what? The world the honkies built was dead, and somehow they would have to start over. A patch of farm, and a few like Chick and Cassie to show them how to work it, that was what they needed. The farmland was all there, under the water. If the water ever withdrew... But the drizzle went on and on. The fire was almost out, and the freshwater ocean was still there, too dark to see, but still there, with its floating garbage and drowned corpses of cattle and men. And behind was a single hill, the only place from which Jackie could watch the fire. Aleem went up the hill. He moved like a blind man, feeling for branches and pushing them aside, shuffling so as not to break an ankle. Presently he said, "Jackie?" The voice was close.
"Yeah, Aleem."
Aleem climbed the rest of the way. Jackie was right at the peak, a man of average size in a coat three sizes too big, with his back turned. Aleem said, "Why can't you leave Cassie alone?"
"I tried."
"You trying to get me killed?"
"I tried, Aleem. I even went to that maid. She's got nothing but a cunt, that woman. But I went to her, thinking I could ease my mind. She turned me down, set Swan on me, said it was his turn. She sleeps with three a night, any prick that asks, but she pushes me off, me."
"She wants your head fucked up." Aleem began to see the right way to go.
"She likes fights. She don't know who stuck that knife in James, so she's going to get us all to kill each other. She fucks with Elliot and tells Rob she was raped. She don't spread her legs for you, so you'll fight Chick. If I say so, she's got six men want my blood. Jackie, what do I do?"
Get him to think with his brain now, instead of his dick.
What we need, Jackie said, is something to take the brother's mind off women.
He said that as if he thought it was funny and sad at the same time. That'd take some doing.
Aleem, where are we going? What happens to us?
Hard to say. He could talk with Jackie, but he couldn't tell anybody that he didn't know what they'd do, where they'd go. And Jackie was smart. Jackie had been big in the Panthers once, political, like Aleem. They'd worked together, Jackie to stir up the ghetto until Aleem got what he wanted from City Hall, then quiet things so it looked like Aleem's doing. Get Jackie thinking, but don't tell him, don't tell anybody, that Aleem Nassour was scared and wet and miserable and all fucked up and just about out of control.
Black power's finished, Jackie was saying. Not enough blacks, not enough power.
Yeah, I got that figured out, Aleem said.
And there ain't enough of us, Jackie continued. Not enough to hold on anywhere. Chick says it'll take a couple of acres each to live on. 100 acres could keep us alive, but it won't. Not enough of us know farming. Need people to do some of the work. 2 acres for each one of them, too. Takes a big spread, and we can't hold a big spread.
We can't hold a little one, Aleem said.
Right on. So what we have to do is link up, find a honky outfit we can work with. Politics, not blood.
Jackie was staring off into the night, his voice quiet, but Aleem could feel it. Jackie had been brooding about this a long time.
Damn system's been smashed, Jackie said. What we always wanted, systems gone. Got rid of the pigs and City Hall and the rich bastards, and it don't do us any good at all, 'cause there ain't enough of us.
Shit. I brought out all I could, Aleem said. You saying I didn't?
No, you did all you could, Jackie said. Not your fault, it wasn't enough. Aleem, step up here and look down.
Through the drizzle there was a blur of light. It had to be a campfire, somebody's campfire, glowing beside the shoreline to the north.
I see better than you, Jackie said. So maybe you don't see that it's 2 fires. 2. How many people does it take before it's worth making 2 fires?
A lot. Think they saw ours?
Nah, nobody's come up this way. And they don't give a shit whether somebody sees them or not. Think about that.
Power. That group didn't have to hide. It had power.
A posse? After us?
Nah, we haven't gone north of here. Nobody up that way has any reason to be after us.
Maybe this'll take Chick's mind off killing me, Jackie said.
How you gonna distract me? You saw those fires and didn't come tell me.
I had to keep watch, and nobody's come up here. I watched.
He'd been scared of Chick. All right, you stay here. You watch. I'll send Gay back with the binoculars. In gray morning light, Jackie came down the south side of the hill. Aleem already had his people up and their gear stowed, and the brothers stood around waiting with guns uncomfortable in their hands. Jackie went first to Chick and Cassie. Aleem didn't hear what they said, but Chick had a shotgun in his hand, and he didn't use it. Then Jackie turned aside and came to report.
They're up, and they're organized. 50, 60, maybe more. Maybe a lot more. They don't all get to one place at once. There's women, and a honky that's half rabbit, and he's wearing what's left of a business suit and a tie. The rest is army.
Jackie waited for that to sink in. Army? Oh, shit, Aleem Nassour said.
Funny thing about them mothers, Jackie said. They got army uniforms and little mean-looking rifles, but they don't act army. And there's others in civvies.
Aleem frowned. Jackie went on.
They got more than the rifles, Aleem. They got machine guns and things like stovepipes.
Bazookas, Aleem said.
Yeah, and a thing about as big as a cannon, except 2 men carry it. They can blow a house apart with those things, I think. I saw 'em on TV once, and I think they're heading north.
Aleem digested that. It meant this group had to have come from the east, since they'd never seen them before. They certainly hadn't come from the west, out of the lake that covered the San Joaquin.
"Maybe we better follow them,"
Swan said. He'd been listening.
"They sound like tough mothers."
"And everything's picked clean before we get to it," Aleem said. He didn't want to say much. He didn't know what to do. It would be better to hear what the others thought before he said anything at all. "I best go up there and have a look." He left Swan in charge, with instructions on where to run if the army outfit moved toward them, and let Jackie lead him up the hill. Shit, he thought he'd had troubles before. Just what he always wanted, to go up against army guns with a dozen Saturday night specials and some shotguns. "Now we know," he said. Jackie looked at him. "Why everybody'd been hiding," Aleem said. No food anywhere. 2 days ago they'd taken a raft out to a half-sunken supermarket, and it was already looted. All they could find was weird stuff like canned salmon and anchovies, and not much of that. That army outfit must have picked it clean. It was getting lighter when he reached the top of the hill. Jackie motioned, and Aleem went to his belly and crawled forward through the bushes until he found Gay. Aleem's fur coat was covered with mud from crawling, but those army guys had to have binoculars too, and they had to be keeping watch, or they wouldn't have lived this long. The stranger camp was more than a mile away, right down by the shore. There were foxholes and low fortifications around it. Organized. It looked organized. And there were a lot of people, and they sat around fires they didn't even bother to hide, and they had food. Aleem counted 7 women. "The women do most of the work," Gay said. "Them and the rabbit stud in the blue suit, and a lot of them are white. But I counted 10 blood, and one's the sergeant." The sergeant. Aleem digested this, too. "And they do what he tells them."
"They jump when he waves his arms," Gay said.
"Officers?"
"None I saw. I think the sergeant's in charge."
"They done it. Aleem, they made it," Jackie said. "Shit, they really did."
Aleem didn't say anything. Jackie would explain. After a moment, he did.
"What we were talking about last night," Jackie said. His voice was full of excitement. "Not black power, just power. And there's a lot of them, Aleem."
"Not all that many."
"Maybe they want recruits," Jackie said.
"You crazy?" Gay snorted. "Join the fucking army?"
"Shut up." Aleem continued to study the camp through the binoculars. There was orderly activity down there. Garbage carried outside the camp and dumped into holes, sentries and outposts, tubs of water over the fire, and everybody washed out their mess kits in hot water. That camp was run like an army, but there was something wrong. It wasn't all the same. Something just wasn't the way it ought to be.
"Aleem, they got what we want," Jackie said. "Power. Enough guns to do whatever they want. We could join up with them. We could hold any place we wanted. Shit, we could do better. That many people, we could take over this whole goddamn valley. Shit, keep growing, keep recruiting. We could own the whole fucking state."
"You've been sniffing?" Gay asked.
"Shut up," Aleem said again, and he said it so they knew he meant it. The quick silence was gratifying. Power. And that was the problem. How could Aleem Nassor have power if they joined up with that army? They don't have no wheels at all.
"A bike. Big Honda. It went scouting north with 2 on it. 1 blood, 1 honky."
"In uniform?"
"The honky had on overalls," Gay said. His tone made it clear he didn't know what was going on, and didn't know why Aleem wanted to know either.
"No wheels. We got a truck, and we know where there's some wheels," Aleem muttered.
"A farmhouse back down the road. 3 trucks, guarded by 10 to 15 men with rifles." Aleem had no chance to take it, but this outfit... He shushed the others as the sergeant came into view. "Blood, all right. A big mother. Not all black. Light brown, with a beard."
"Beard? In the army?"
The sergeant wore chevrons, though, and a big pistol on his belt, and he was pointing to people, and when he did, they got up and did things, brought wood for the fires, washed cooking pots. He wasn't shouting, and he didn't have to wave his arms and scream. Power. That man had power, and he knew how to use it. Alim studied him closely. Then he looked up and grinned. "That's the hook," Gay said.
"Huh?"
Jackie began to grin. "It's the hook." Alim treated himself to a whistling sigh of relief. "I know him. We can deal." It would take setting up. Alim had to talk to the hook as an equal, as a commander of men. They had to talk as two men with power. He couldn't let Hooker know just how bad things were. Alim left Jackie on the hill and went back down to camp. Time to do some shouting and screaming. Time to get those bastards to work. By noon, his camp was organized. It looked good, and it looked like there were more of them than they were. He took Jackie and his brother Harold and went toward the army camp.
"Shit, I'm scared," Harold said as they walked toward the shoreline.
"Scared of the hook?"
"He beat the shit out of me once," Harold said, "back in 9th grade.
"Yeah, and you had it coming," Alim said.
"Okay, they've seen us.
Harold, you go in. Leave the rifle here. Go in, hands up, and tell Sergeant Hooker I want to talk to him. And be nice to him, you know? Respectful."
"You can bet your ass on that," Harold said.
He straightened and walked tall, hands out where they could see they were empty. He tried to whistle. Alim was aware that there were movements to his right. Hooker had sent men out to flank him. Alim turned and shouted to purely imaginary followers, "Hold it up there, you bastards! This is a peace talk, dig? I'll skin the first dude that shoots, and you know I'll do it!"
"Too much," Alim thought. "Like I'm worried they won't do what I say. But the army dudes heard me, and it stopped them. And Harold's in the camp, and nobody's done any shooting yet."
"And he's done it," Alim shouted to himself. "He's talking to Hooker, and by God, he's done it. Hook's coming out to meet me. We're all right. All fucking right." For the first time since Hammerfall, Alim Nassor felt hope and pride. Two heavy farm trucks ground across the mudflats, taking a tortuous path to the new island in the San Joaquin Sea. They stopped at a supermarket, still half-flooded, glass windows scraped of mud by laborious effort. Armed men jumped out and took up positions nearby.
"Let's go,"
Cal White said. He carried Deke Wilson's submachine gun. White led the way into the drowned building, wading waist-deep in filthy water. The others followed. Rick Delante coughed and tried to breathe through his mouth. The smell of death was overpowering. He looked for someone to talk to, Peter or Johnny Baker, but they were at the far end of the column. Although it was their second day at the store, none of the astronauts had got used to the smells.
"If it was up to me, I'd wait another week," Kevin Murray said.
Murray was a short, burly man with long arms. He'd been a feed store clerk and was lucky enough to have married a farmer's sister.
"Wait a week, and those army bastards may be here," Cal White called from inside. "Hold up a second."
White went on with another man and their only working flashlight, hand-pumped, and Deke's submachine gun. The gun seemed an irrelevant obscenity to Rick. There was too much death all around them. He wasn't going to say that. Last night, Deke had taken in a refugee, a man from southwards with information to trade for a meal. A gang of blacks had been terrorizing the South Valley, and now they were linked up with the army cannibals. It might not be long before they came to Deke Wilson's turf again.
Poor bastards, Rick thought.
He could sympathize. Blacks in this shattered world. No status, no place to go, wanted nowhere. Of course they'd joined the cannibals, and of course the local survivors were looking strangely at Rick Delante again.
"Clear! Let's get at it!" White called from inside.
They waded in, a dozen men, 3 astronauts, and 9 survivors. A driver brought one of the trucks around so that the headlights shone into the wrecked store. Rick wished they hadn't. Bodies bobbed in the filthy water. He choked hard and brought the cloth to his face. White had sprinkled a dozen drops of gasoline on it. the sweet, sickening smell of gasoline was better than... Kevin Murray went to a shelf of cans. He lifted a can of corn. It was eaten through with rust. "Gone," he said.
"Damn!"
"Sure wish we had a flashlight," another farmer said. A flashlight would help, Rick knew, but some things are better done in gloomy darkness. He pushed rotten remains away from a shelf. Glass jars, pickles. He called to the others, and they began carrying the pickles out.
"What's this stuff, Rick?"
Kevin Murray asked. He brought another jar.
"Mushrooms," Murray shrugged. "Better than nothing."
"Thanks. Sure wish I had my glasses back. You ever wonder why I don't pack a gun? Can't see as far as the sights." Rick tried to concentrate on glasses, but he didn't know anything about how you might grind lenses. He moved through the aisles, carrying things the others had discovered, searching for more, pushing aside the corpses until even that became routine. But you had to talk about something else.
"Cans don't last long, do they?" Rick said.
He stared at rotten canned stew.
"Sardine cans last fine. God knows why. I think somebody's already been here. There ain't so much as the last store. We got most of what was here yesterday, anyway."
He looked thoughtfully at old corpses bobbing about him.
"Maybe they ate it all. Trapped here."
Rick didn't answer. His toes had brushed glass. They were all working in open-toed sandals taken from the shoe store up the road. They couldn't work barefoot for fear of broken glass, and why ruin good boots? Now his toes had brushed a cool, smooth curve of glass bottle. Rick held his breath and submerged. Near floor level, he found rows of bottles, lots of them, different shapes. 50-50 it was bottled water, barely worth room aboard the truck, but he picked one up and surfaced.
"Apple juice, by God. Hey, gang, we need hands here."
They waded down the aisles, Peter and Johnny and the farmers, all dog-tired and dirty and wet, moving like zombies. Some had strength to smile. Rick and Kevin Murray dipped for the bottles and handed them up, because they were the ones who didn't carry guns. White, the man in charge, turned slowly away with two bottles, turned back.
"Good, Rick. You did good,"
he said, and smiled, and turned slowly away and waded toward the doorway. Rick followed. Someone yelled. Rick set his bottles on an empty shelf to give himself speed. That had to be Saul on sentry duty, but Rick didn't have a gun. Saul yelled again.
"No danger, I repeat, no danger, but you guys gotta see this."
"Go back for the bottles." "Hell with it." Rick pushed past something he wouldn't look at, but the floating mass had the feel, the weight of a small dead man or a large dead woman, and waded out into the light. The parking lot was almost half full of cars, 40 or 50 cars abandoned when the rains came. The hot rain must have fallen so fast that car motors were drowned before the customers in the shopping center could decide to move. So the cars had stayed, and many of the customers. The water washed around and in and out of the cars. Saul was still at his post on the roof of the supermarket. It would have done him no good to come closer. He was far-sighted, and his glasses had been smashed, like Murray's. He pointed down at what was washing against the side of a Volkswagen bus and called,
"Will someone tell me what that is? It ain't no cow."
They formed a semicircle around it, their feet braced against the water's gentle westward current, this same flow that held the strange body against the bus. It was smaller than a man. It was all the colors of decay. The big, drastically bent legs were almost falling off. What was it? It had arms. For a mad moment, Rick pictured Hammerfall as the first step in an interstellar invasion, or as part of a program for tourists from other worlds. Those tiny arms, the long mouth gaping in death, the Chianti bottle torso.
"I'll be damned," he said. "It's a kangaroo."
"Well, I never saw a kangaroo like that,"
White said with fine contempt.
"It's a kangaroo."
"But," Rick snapped,
"does your newspaper run pictures of animals 2 weeks dead? Mine never did. It's a dead kangaroo. That's why it looks funny."
Jacob Vinge had crowded close to the beast.
"No pouch," he said. "Kangaroos have pouches."
The breeze shifted. The crescent of men opened at one end.
"Maybe it's a male," Deke Wilson said. "I don't see balls either. Did kangaroos have, overt genitalia?"
"Oh, this is stupid. Where would it come from? There ain't any zoo closer than..."
"Where?"
Johnny Baker nodded.
"Griffith Park Zoo. The quake must have ripped some of the cages apart. No telling how the poor beast got this far north before he drowned or starved. Look close, gentlemen. You'll never see another."
Rick stopped listening. He backed out of the ark and looked around him. He wanted to scream. They had come at dawn yesterday. They had worked all of yesterday and today, and it must be near sunset. None of them had even discussed what must have happened here, yet it was obvious enough. Scores of customers must have been trapped here when the first flash rain drowned their cars. They had waited in the supermarket for the rain to stop. They had waited for rescue. They had waited while the water rose and rose. At the end, the electric doors hadn't worked. Some must have left through the back to drown in the open. In the supermarket, there were half-empty shelves, and the water floated with corn cobs and empty bottles and orange rinds and half-used loaves of bagged bread. They had not died hungry, but they had died, for their corpses floated everywhere in the supermarket and in the flooded parking lot. Scores of bodies. Most were women, but there were men and children, too, bobbing gently among the submerged cars.
"Are you?"
Rick whispered. He bowed his head and cleared his throat and shrieked.
"Are you all crazy?"
They turned, shocked and angry.
"If you want to see corpses, look around you. Here."
His hand brushed a stained and rotting flowered dress.
"And there,"
pointing to a child close enough for Deke to touch.
"And there,"
to a slack face behind the windshield of the Volks bus itself.
"Can you look anywhere without seeing somebody dead? Why are you crowding like jackals around a dead kangaroo?" "You shut up! Shut up!"
Kevin Murray's fists were balled at his sides, the knuckles white. But he didn't move, and presently he looked away, and so did the others. All but Jacob Vinge. His voice held a tremor.
"We got used to it. We just got used to it. We had to, goddammit."
The current shifted slightly. The kangaroo, if that's what it was, washed around the edge of the bus and began to move away. The Jeep Wagoneer had once been bright orange with white trim, a luxury station wagon that only incidentally had four-wheel drive and off-road tires. Now it was splashed with brown and green paint in a camouflage pattern. Two men in army uniform sat in the front seat, rifles held erect between their knees. Alim Nassour and Sergeant Hooker sat in back. There was little conversation as the car wound through muddy fields and ruined almond groves. When it reached the encampment, sentries saluted, and as the wagoneer came to a stop, the driver and guards jumped out to open the rear doors. Alim nodded thanks to the driver. Hooker did not seem to notice the men. Nassour and Hooker went to a tent at one side of the camp. It was a new tent from a sporting goods store. Green nylon stretched over aluminum poles, and it did not leak. A charcoal hibachi inside kept it warm and dry. A kettle bubbled over the charcoal, and a white girl waited inside to pour hot tea as the two men sat on folding chairs. Hooker nodded dismissal when the tea was poured. The girl left, and the guards took up posts outside, well out of earshot. When the girl was gone, Sergeant Hooker grinned broadly.
"Pretty good life, Peanut."
Nassar's grin faded at the name.
"For God's sake, don't call me that, man."
Hooker grinned again.
"Okay, nobody to hear us in here."
"Yeah, but you might forget." Alim shuddered. He hadn't been called Peanut since eighth grade, when they studied the life of George Washington Carver, and inevitably the name was settled on George Washington Carver Davis, until he obliterated it with fists and a razor blade embedded in a cake of soap.
"Not much out there,"
Hooker said. He sipped tea, grateful for the warmth.
"No,
Their scouting expedition had told them nothing they hadn't expected, except that once there was a break in the rain and they saw snow on the tops of the high